Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Alan Mackey. I have known Alan for a little bit over a year, and he is someone that represents and also is very strongly associated with various left groups. Alan, thanks again for joining the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, what I'd like for you to do is take probably around a minute, 2 minutes, just to share a little bit about yourself, the organizations that you represent, and what you were doing mainly to represent or support left candidates in 2012.
Okay. Right now, my main activity is I'm involved in organizing casino workers in the Indian gaming industry. And I've been involved in the peace movement, the environmental movements, and the civil rights movements for many years, going back over 40 years. Another thing that I'm very involved in is trying to push to get affirmative action enforced in Minnesota and Michigan. And people don't understand that a lot of public funds are being expended at this point. I mean, we're talking billions and billions of dollars, and affirmative action is not being enforced in any of these public works projects. An example would be the Viking Stadium, which is a public works project. Literally, almost $1 billion of taxpayer money is being pumped into this, and affirmative action is not being enforced, even by the Democratic governor. In the state of Michigan, a $1 billion bridge is going to be built across the Detroit River from Detroit into Windsor. Again, affirmative action is not even part of the plan. In Minnesota, there's a bridge that's a $1 billion bridge, $1 billion-plus bridge that's going to be built jointly by the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin. Affirmative action is not being discussed in that project. So, you know, we've got a lot of problems in this country, and what, you know, we've been pushing for is that, you know, we've been saying to people, hey, poverty is a big problem in this country, and if working people don't have jobs, it's just common sense they're going to be poor. So the solution to poverty, the main solution to poverty is getting people living wage jobs that are not poverty wage jobs. So,
exactly.
You know, I've been involved in the NAACP and the Communist Party, you know, a number of peace organizations for a number of years.
And what are your roots? Apparently your roots in working with various left groups, Communist Party, Socialist Party. I'm assuming it stems back from the late 60s, early 70s. Is that correct?
Right. It actually goes back to the early 60s when the high school that I was going to, Union High School in Grand Rapids, Michigan, was part of a plan to integrate the public schools, and it faced massive opposition, and I was part of the NAACP Youth Council at the time. And that's where my activism really started, and from there it went to into activities against the Vietnam War. When I was drafted for the war, I told the government, if you take me in your army, you better worry about which direction I'm going to be shooting. And General Hershey, who was the head of Selective Service, he said I would be the first person prosecuted for treason for the way that I reported for induction. You know, I didn't refuse to take the step forward. I openly told them my political views, and I told them the Vietnamese weren't my enemy, and that the generals mm-hmm. and the Nixon and these people that were pursuing this dirty war in Vietnam, that these were our enemies. And if they wanted to put a gun in my hand and tell me to shoot somebody, I was going to shoot those people who I felt were the enemy. And a long battle began over whether or not I was going to be tried for treason. Eventually, General Hershey backed off, and no charges were ever brought. But it made great big sensational headlines all across the country.
So they were actually taking legal actions against you, correct?
Oh, sure, yeah. I've been arrested over 60 times for my political views for passing out leaflets. You know, it was real hard to pass out leaflets even against the Vietnam War. We were just coming out of McCarthyism at that time. And people that passed out leaflets on a street corner that marched in front of federal buildings, you know, they were routinely arrested for all kinds of petty crimes, from civil refusing to obey police orders to move on, and then they charge you with the resisting police officers and all this crap. And yeah, my whole life. Just the other day, I was arrested about 2 weeks ago on a 21-year-old warrant. The charges were later dropped, but a $10,000 had been placed on me. And, you know, people had to raise this money to get me out of jail. This is the kind of harassment that activists, not just me, but activists all across this country have faced for many, many years as a result of FBI repression.
Exactly.
I was one of the people that sued the Michigan State Police and the FBI to end these so-called Red Squads. And as far as I know, in Michigan, this is the only place where we had a ruling from a judge that ordered these Red Squads to cease and desist their activity. That was in 1974. Now the police are back at it again, completely in violation of a judge's order. Well, the judge is dead, and nobody has brought forth any kind of court action to put an end to this, you know. So these are all problems that we face, problems with our democracy. Our democracy is under attack every day in this country. And
right, exactly, and much of it really stems from our democracy as working people is being attacked across this country. Ellen, you were very involved in the 2012 campaign with various left groups and left candidates, Jill Stein, myself, also Stephen Durham, and as I mentioned, you were very supportive of many of those campaigns and working to unite the left. Could you discuss, in regards to the 2012 election, how the re-election of Barack Obama will have an impact on working people, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's going to have a terrible impact. I think we're in for a very rough time. It's been stated by a number of people that while Obama may not be the worst evil of the candidates, he is the most effective evil. And I think that's very important that working people understand that. You know, we're in for very rough times. Obama's going to try and shove austerity measures down our throats. And he's going to try and, you know, cut back on Social Security in a number of ways. He's going to try and cut back on Medicare and Medicaid. He's stated his intent is to reach across the aisle to create some kind of grand bargain with the Republicans. That only means one thing, a disaster for working people. And we've seen part of that disaster in action in with Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast, where, you know, these private outfits have been brought in to try and supposedly solve the problems of the people that have been hurt by Hurricane Sandy, and they can't do it. FEMA hasn't done its job, and the Red Cross hasn't done its job. And I don't know why the left hasn't brought forward the idea that we need to reestablish the Works Progress Administration, WPA, and the Civilian Conservation Corps, and programs like CETA to cope with the problems on the East Coast now that as a result of Hurricane Sandy. That's the only way that these people are going to see their problems resolved, through huge government programs, putting people to work, solving their problems. And Obama's not going to do that.
The funding, in your opinion, and also I probably share your opinion, is the funding there?
Well, the funding is there for sure.
For these type of programs.
Yeah, all we have to do is tax the hell out of the rich and end these dirty wars and close down these 800 military bases around the globe defending Wall Street's interest. As working people, we've got no interest in having bases anyplace else in the world, and we for sure don't have any business fighting these dirty wars in Iraq, Afghanistan. All these drone attacks, every one of these drone attacks cost hundreds of millions of dollars, killing mostly innocent people. And, you know, people are going to have to come to terms. One of our labor leaders in this country, William Z. Foster, a very heroic labor leader, he said that one thing that the U.S. working class really needs is a good dose of anti-imperialist education. And I think that's proving true today. People don't understand the foreign policy of this country and who it serves. It serves Wall Street's interest, not the interest of working people.
And well, after looking at the results of the last election of a couple of weeks ago, do you think people are beginning to receive that message from the left?
Well, yeah, I think they've been receiving that message for a long time. Every poll indicates that the American people want to stop this insane military spending and war spending and start spending that money on human needs, everything from education and housing to health care. You know, we could have a national public health care system in this country providing everybody with free health care, putting literally 12 to 15 million people to work, and have these community health care centers spread out all across this country instead of 800 military bases around the world. And this would be a program that people would support. Yet all these politicians keep saying the free market will solve the problem. The free market won't solve the healthcare mess. The free market can't solve the housing mess. The free market can't solve the public education mess. Only increasing public programs and defending those public programs can resolve the problems that we're having in this country.
Well, Alan, if the third-party candidates, even myself, when I was Alexander Mendoza campaign in 2012, we ran campaigns, Jill Stein, myself, Stephen Durham, Gary Johnson, other third-party candidates. Why is it that the third-party candidates then receive greater support, considering that they were carrying these messages in regards to shifting our priorities? What happened in 2012 and the third-party candidates?
Well, I have a personal opinion about that that isn't shared by a whole lot of
people. And that's what I like to hear.
I think the problem is that liberals, progressives, and the left have to come together and bring forward a unity slate at a national level for president and probably for Congress and the Senate in order to break this two-party trap that we're caught in. And that's what people are looking for. Every place that I go, people are saying to me, well, you know, you're supporting Stuart Alexander and Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein. Well, how come these people can't work together? You know, I've taken the position for a long time that the left should come together and liberals and progressives, and it would have been a good idea for Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson to run on a joint ticket with you and other people. It should be announced that you were going to be part of the cabinet, you know, and that this is the kind of unified slate we should bring before the American people. I don't think the left has the resources to go it alone in these individual campaigns. You know, it's too expensive. It's too time-consuming. We're wasting the little resources that we have. And right now, I really think that you and Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson and, you know, anybody else you can find that were candidates should come together and issue a statement that says, hey, you know we know we need a program like WPA and the CCC so that we can confront these natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy and stuff, because there's no reason. This is the richest country in the world, the wealthiest country, the most industrialized country in the world, and the response to Hurricane Sandy has been even worse than anything from some of these third world countries. You know, the Cubans respond much better to hurricane disasters than a country like the United States does. There's no reason for that.
Alan, as you mentioned, you've been working to bring left groups, even left candidates during the last election, bringing them together. And you're working with an organization. It's the New Progressive Alliance.
Right.
Can you share a little bit about what the New Progressive Alliance, what that organization is about, and your successes over the last few years, especially during this last election cycle?
Well, our real success, I think, you know, we've tried to unify people on the left seeking political alternatives to this two-party trap of the Democrats and Republicans that's offered by Wall Street. And I think we've had our major success has been in getting yourself, Jill Stein, and Rocky Anderson to agree to the supporting the unified, what we call the unified platform, unified progressive platform, which essentially is a platform that is based on past campaigns of progressive and socialist candidates from the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, Fighting Bob LaFollette in Wisconsin, and a number of other successful campaigns across the country over the years. And we think that's the way to go now, too, that we need to be involved in, even if we can't be in the same parties and same organizations because we have some disagreements and differences of opinion, we think there has to be at some point some minimal program that the American people can relate to that we can all come together around and say, here's our slate of candidates running on this platform. And that's our main goal and objective right now. You know, mm-hmm. We would have loved to see a unified slate. And we were pushing hard for Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein and yourself to come together in this last election. But I think that all of you had probably announced too late in order for there to be a broad discussion. Now we have some time to have that discussion. But the discussion, I think, should take place in a way that promotes some kind of program that we can all come together on. Like, I would like to see you and Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson all come out with a statement saying, we've seen what the results of Hurricane Sandy and, the real disaster that struck there. And because we don't have programs like the WPA and CCC that can move in and help people with their their immediate problems and the rebuilding of their communities, their homes and everything, that, you know, these people are going to be suffering for years. After all, we still got people without electricity, I think, on the East Coast there. We still have people that have never seen anybody from FEMA or the Red Cross. We have people that can't get access to water and food. You know, what is this? Obama has sent in some kind of private enterprise company to supposedly, you know, help the people there. Well, they're just helping the wealthy. This Hurricane Sandy has hurt the poorest of the poor the most because these are the communities that are not getting the help. You know, what are we going to see? Are we going to see great big million-dollar mansions built along the coast there in place of the working-class communities that were there? I think that's probably what we're going to see. That's the tendency in this country. We saw that in New Orleans. You know, the casinos and all these big operations are the first places to be rebuilt. This is a disgrace. And they tell working people, you know, go live in these old dilapidated trailers and everything else. I've been in contact with some of these people who were moved to Texas from New Orleans. They're living in the most horrendous housing conditions imaginable. You know, this is a shame, and the same thing's going to happen with these people on the East Coast now with Hurricane Sandy if we don't step in and say, we have a way to solve this problem. The WPA and CCC could be brought back into existence within a couple months. And probably within a couple of weeks on an emergency basis if the government really put its mind to it, like they put their mind to fighting these dirty wars.
Right. You know? One of the things we see just recently, we see how Bernanke, how he, when he came out in a recent statement that he was going to pump $40 billion a month into the economy, and basically $40 billion into the economy is just to shore up Wall Street and to make certain that we don't see an economic crash sooner than later. But what you're saying is, and I agree with you, is that we need to start using using funds to start revitalizing and also to bring about reconstruction in this area and also put thousands and tens of thousands of people back to work. And that's what you're saying, correct?
Sure, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people could be put to work right now. In fact, the very unemployed, the very people who have been unemployed for so long there on the East Coast, the poorest of the poor, could be put to work rebuilding their communities. And, you know, through WPA and CCC type programs. And we've got to ask, you know, why isn't this being done? And I think we all know the reason it's not being done is because the left hasn't come together and pushed that kind of program to where the American people can see. You know, we can go this way or we can go that way. We can continue down this way of wars and injustices and everything else, or we can change course in this country and push for, you know, human needs to be met. And I think that's the whole thing. We recently had a group of, I don't know what it was, 30 or 40 so-called progressives that met with Obama. You know, Obama chose them. He chose to meet with them, and then he said, you can't bring tape recorders to the meeting or any other recording devices, and you can't even take notes during our meeting. And, you know, people like Ben Jealous, the president of the NAACP, agreed to participate in this meeting. The president of the AFL-CIO agreed to participate in this meeting. Even people like Jim Wallace, who I would never have expected to participate under such a situation, participated in this meeting. Obama tried to pull the same crap with the Des Moines Register when he was seeking their endorsement for his reelection. And they said, no, we're not going to engage in anything like this. Now, this is supposed to be a democracy. Why don't we know what Obama told these 30 or 40 so-called progressives that he brought together under the auspices of that he couldn't even take notes during the meeting? This is a disgrace. It never should have happened, and somebody should, or that was in that meeting should come out and say what took place there. Because we know from past experiences, Obama made the statement while he was campaigning first for president, that he said he was for a single-payer universal health care system just like they have in Canada. And we have that in video and on audio, him making that statement to a group in Illinois. And we see he did that for political purposes, and he lies and lies and lies about what he intends to do in order to get these votes. He gets Wall Street's money to get himself get elected and reelected, but he needs the votes from people, so he has to create some kind of popular agenda that he can hoodwink the people with in order to get those votes. This,
right.
He should not be allowed to get away with this. Let's put something real under his nose, like I'm talking about, bring back the WPA and CCC. Roosevelt, Obama is often compared to Roosevelt, and you have all this stuff about, Roosevelt said, well, make me do it. Well, Obama should be made to do this. And what Roosevelt did in order to create the WPA and CCC, he used his executive order privilege to create the programs, and then he dared and challenged Congress not to fund the programs. And the same thing should be done right now.
The president has this authority to do this.
Oh, sure he does.
He has this authority.
Yeah.
And the thing is, America would see that there's a definite need right now, not only creating jobs, but as you mentioned, to take care of that disaster from that hurricane, Hurricane Sandy. Many people right now need assistance from the government, and the timing for this would be just ideal.
Right.
Alan, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take another minute and a half. I just want you to reintroduce yourself. Today we have Alan Mackey. Mackey, he's joining us. He's a person that has worked very closely with various presidential candidates on the left organizations for over 40 years. But anyway, Alan, let me just have you to share a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background, and then we're going to continue with this interview, please.
Sure. I come from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm now living in my home is War Road, Minnesota. I'm working with casino workers that are trying to organize unions in the Indian gaming industry, workers that don't want to continue working in these smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages. They have no rights under state or federal labor laws. And I've been involved in the environmental movements and peace movements for a number of years. You know, I'm a socialist, a communist, call it what you want. I believe that we should push for the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights to be put in place for all people, and that the anniversary of that document is coming up on December 10th. And, just in general, I think that people got to begin to get really involved in these struggles for peace and social and economic justice, even if it means creating local organizations. I think it's going to take grassroots and rank-and-file organizations all across this country to do this, because the organizations that are in place, the foundation-funded outfits, they're not going to do this.
Alan, I'm going to get back into some of the things you were saying, things that can be help with the solutions that we're looking for. You say tax the rich, in the wars, tax the rich, tax corporations.
Right.
What? First of all, I believe that we need to end those Bush tax cuts. Definitely the wrong direction. But when you say tax the rich, tax corporations, what kind of taxes are we talking about?
Whatever is needed. I mean, it's easy for the people in government to figure this out. You know, that's what we pay people to do. We got to figure what it's going to cost for a WPA and CCC program and maybe a CETA program, and then say there's got to be an emergency tax placed on the rich to fund these programs. After all, the wealth of this country has been created by working people, and these people on Wall Street, these vultures, have been stealing this wealth from us for years and years and years. I don't think it's too much to ask them to pay it back now that we're in big trouble. You know, we got Hurricane Sandy. We got a crumbling economy that's creating. The human misery that it's creating is just unbelievable. Most people aren't familiar with the poverty on Indian reservations. I work with people on Indian reservations all the time across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And you know, on the Indian reservations, the people are suffering anywhere from 65% to 85% official unemployment.
Unemployment.
Yeah, and the poverty is the way people are living. It's just like in the worst of the third world conditions. It's just unbelievable. Kids aren't getting food. Kids are going to school hungry. The housing conditions are terrible. People are living in the same kind of dilapidated housing that people live in, in third world countries. This is a crime. It's a crime against humanity. And between Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, we've got tens of thousands of Native American people living under these horrendous conditions of poverty. And I haven't heard one single politician in any of these three states come into a community for anything except trying to get funds for their campaigns from this Indian gaming industry. And it's, you know, you got this tribal corruption that's been put in place by this so-called Indian gaming industry. It's an industry where a bunch of rich white mobsters own every single slot machine and table game. And, you know, you got a problem where poverty is getting worse and worse and worse, while literally billions of dollars are coming into these Native American communities and people aren't seeing a single penny of this.
Right, exactly. So,
you know, and we have the same problem on a much larger level with the corporations and stuff all across this country. Working people create this tremendous wealth. You know, the people, the Wall Street people, the capitalists, they don't create anything. They don't create any wealth. All wealth is created by labor. And,
Course,
Mother Nature works, you know, very hard to creating this wealth. But it's the laborers of working people that have created all this wealth. And now we've got to say we're entitled to have this wealth used to solve our problems. It's as simple as that. These people hogging this wealth are what created all these problems to start with. You know, people cannot buy back what they've been producing.
Now, we see that, and as you mentioned, taxing the big corporations, we can see that the corporations are benefiting from labor. They're benefiting from the resources of the earth. That's one of the areas that we need to be able to tap into the resources, the financial resources, to help to bring create jobs. The other thing is that you mentioned is these wars. Right now, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has cost American taxpayers well over $3 trillion, and that's still that war is still going on. How closing bases? We have over 800 military bases throughout the world. What can Obama do in that regards?
Well, he can shut those bases down, and he can end these wars now. You know, he says he's going to end the war in a year or 2 years in Afghanistan. Well, why can't he end that war right now, bring the troops home, and use that money for things that we need right here and now to solve the problems of the American people? These wars never should have been started in the first place. I think the majority of the American people agree with that. You know, now we're going to, Obama's going to get us into wars with Syria and Iran probably. And, you know, he sure is beating the drums of war anyways, and so are the Republicans. And all this costs tremendous amounts of money. I mean, we might as well take this wealth of our nation rather than spend it on wars, and we might as well be dumping it into the ocean for all the good that it does. At least we wouldn't be killing anybody. You know, that's what it amounts to. We're just totally wasting the wealth of this nation on wars and militarism.
What you mentioned in regards to his promises to end the war, many of our listeners may not be aware that President Barack Obama had mentioned in 2007 and in 2008 that he was going to end the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2009. He had mentioned 9 months. Within my first 9 months of being in the White House, he had mentioned that he would end the war. And here we see now he has gone into his second term, and we see no end in sight of these wars. We hear promises, but as you mentioned, the drums of war are still going.
Not only is there no end in sight of these wars, even if the wars themselves end, they only end because the occupation begins. And, you know, we had the first imperialist war the United States was ever involved in and fought was the Spanish-American War. And we're still fighting in the Philippines today, and we're still holding Puerto Rico as a colony. And this has cost us a tremendous amount of money. I can't even find a single politician who can tell us the complete and total cost of the Spanish-American War to date. And not only that, you know, we're arming this Israeli killing machine to go in and commit these pogroms against the Palestinian people in Gaza Strip right now, all paid for by U.S. taxpayers, just senseless, outright carnage and murder against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Just think of what we could be doing here in this country with that money. And that money, our tax dollars, are going to fund this killing. I mean, the barbarism, it's just total barbarism and cannibalism that we're talking about.
Alan, this, and now that you mentioned what has taken place in Gaza and against the Palestinian people, and I know this is something that you just had something posted just recently on Facebook, emergency global action needed in Gaza. Just share a little bit about some of the things that you've been discussing with various groups in regards to the carnage that has taken place over there, because we can already see that we're on the verge. I shouldn't say on the verge. It is a war, a war against human beings, children, against helpless individuals, and the U.S. is supporting this. But just share a little bit about what is going on with our listeners, please.
Well, what's going on in Gaza Strip today with our tax dollars is very reminiscent of the kind of carnage and barbarism that the U.S. military carried out against the Native American people to grab their land. And, you know, that connection was recently made at the hearings that were held in New York City, the Bertrand Russell hearings in New York City. And, you know, the people that I talk to say that we got to do something to end this barbarism, and we should bring tremendous pressure to bear on Barack Obama right now to stop the Israeli killing machine, what they're doing. It was bad enough that Barack Obama sat in silence and stuck up his nose as he took his daughters to a Dairy Queen in Hawaii 4 years ago when they carried out this attack on Gaza, the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people. Today we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing the same pattern developing. First you have the presidential election, then you have the Israeli killing machine going into action against the Palestinian people in Gaza Strip, and then you have the Israelis using this to build up for their own elections to make sure that a right-wing cabal comes back into power in Israel. And we're seeing the same thing repeated this time. And Barack Obama is part of that. He's part of these war crimes that are being committed against the Palestinian people. These are crimes against humanity. And
the president's not speaking against this.
What?
I say, and President Obama is not speaking against these atrocities that are happening in that area.
Not at all. And
Do you think this is mostly political, leading up to elections, what has taken place?
Well, I think it's political, but I also think that it's part of U.S. imperialism's designs on the world, where they want to, you know, control that region of the world to keep the oil and the gas flowing. And that's what these wars are all about. They're intentionally keeping people fighting. The Israeli people and the Palestinian people have no business fighting with each other. You know, they've lived in that area for years, usually very peacefully. And it's only because imperialism has instigated these wars that, you know, this carnage is taking place today. There's no reason for it. You know, what legitimate reason do the Israelis have?
There's none.
Carrying out the kind of airstrikes, and now, I don't know, maybe they've already started to invade Gaza Strip now from the ground. I don't know what's been happening in the last few hours or whatever. But apparently they intend to do that. And they've already murdered around 100 people, and there's some 800 people that have been, you know, really seriously wounded, mostly women and children and older people. And there's nobody there that's not being hurt that aren't innocent people. So,
and as you mentioned about these air attacks, the same thing that was happening in Libya and the actions that they took against Gaddafi, here now you have Israeli jets that are going and attacking Palestinians, and there's no actions, nothing is being done by the U.S. to speak out against this.
No, it's and by not saying anything, they're encouraging it. And you know, it's not just jets. The drones are in action there, and everything.
And the drones also.
Yeah.
Now, what we had is if we just go back a few years ago during those elections. You know, the information I have, it was like 1,400 Palestinians were involved in that, you know, where they were actually under attack and 1,400 were killed, and many of those were children. And we have the same thing that is happening now. And I don't think the American public, obviously the corporate media is hiding this from Americans. You don't see this side of what is going, what has taken place. But people need to understand that hundreds of children are being killed and maimed, and nothing is really being done by the international community in that regards either.
No, because we don't have part of the problem, I think, is that our peace movement is as divided as the left in this country. You know, internationally, the peace movement is very divided, and it almost seems like the peace movement is castrated and can't do anything. You know, we should have seen massive outrage organized all over the world, including here in the United States, if our peace movements were working together, but they're not, and that's
no,
a big, big problem. So I don't know what we're going to do about that.
Do you see this also leading up to a greater conflict, possibly with attacks or possibly a war with Iran?
Well, sure. I mean, that's the whole pretext for all of this, I think. They need to whip up this war hysteria. And as long as the wars and the violence is going, they use that as a pretext wherever they want to go, or whether it's into Iran or Syria or any place else in the world. You know, you got Mali and all these other places where there's uprisings by the people, and the people are demanding justice and democracy. And the only thing that they get from their governments and from the United States is repression. And you know, this is a terrible situation. The American people are going to have to rise up against this. That's the only way it's going to stop.
Now, you were saying, going back to the candidates, a starting point,
yeah.
Getting the candidates that were running in the 2012 election, the left candidates, has anything been done to reach out to those candidates to get them to come with a unifying voice to speak about what has taken place over in the Middle East, also to speak about certain things that needs to be done in regards to this recent hurricane that we had? What has been done to reach out to these candidates that were involved in the last election?
Well, I can mostly only speak for myself. I put out an email and a posting on my blog that the New Progressive Alliance has supported, but so far we really haven't heard from the candidates. And, you know, perhaps you should consider approaching Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson and some of the other people and saying, hey, let's take some action on this, what's going on in Gaza right now on it's an emergency basis. You know, we've got to do something together. And, quite frankly, I think if you as a left candidate don't do it, it's not going to get done. The left has always been the catalyst to action on the part of, you know, progressives and liberals, you know. So probably socialists and communists and leftists are going to have to come together and demand this of both Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson. And, you know, it would be good if a statement came from yourself encouraging them to get together with you and issue a joint statement about this. You know, otherwise the American people aren't going to see an alternative to the imperialist jargon and jingoism and national chauvinism that's going on right now. I mean, it's terrible what people are being subjected to day in and day out in this country, and they're not receiving any kind of alternative. You know, you don't even see it really on Facebook or any of the social media where you see people coming together to oppose you know, this horrendous situation we got in Gaza Strip right now where so many people are dying. And it's all needless. There's no reason for this. It's not like Israel faces, you know, some kind of big attack or anything. Most of these rockets that are being shot off, I don't think that these rockets should be shot off. I think that it's a pretense for the Israelis to take action to start with. But the rockets are so primitive, they can't even hit any target, you know. So they're more or less like big firecrackers, and the Israelis now can take those down. I guess they're taking 90% of those out. So I don't really see the sense in these rockets and stuff. I think the Palestinian people can't be expected to defend themselves against the Israeli war machine and U.S. imperialism. It's just an impossible task. It's just like Native Americans couldn't have been expected to stand up to the entire U.S. military on their own. They would have needed support from, you know, the settlers and the other people around them, and they didn't get it, and they were shoved onto reservations. Now you got the people of Gaza Strip shoved into this little section of land, and they're being literally, you know, just bombarded day in and day out by this huge military machine that Israel has going. Funded
in
all,
the international
all the
community, what
dollars.
Is being in the international community, what is being done by countries such as Russia and China?
I don't really see them doing anything, and I don't think we can depend on Russia or China to do anything. Russia and China have both been dragged into this whole scheme of capitalism, and I don't think we can expect either of those governments to do much of anything. They're sort of like Richard Trump here in this country. They make some statements, and you know, they're big blowhards and everything, but when it comes to action, they're not going to do anything because they don't want to bite the hand that's supposedly feeding them right now. That's Wall Street.
Right, and it's capitalism.
You know, yeah, capitalism. And
right.
They're both on the course, you know, capitalist courses right now, both Russia and China, in my opinion. And I don't see much socialism left on the part of the Communist Party in China anymore. What I see is a bunch of people that come begging to Wall Street, and they're all a bunch of corrupt politicians that are following right along as little toads, you know, doing it like a cow with a ring through its nose, following what Wall Street wants them to do.
Well, I want to say, again, we greatly appreciate Alan. He has come on our program today as our special guest, Alan Mackey. And I'm going to give Alan just another minute or so just to reintroduce himself. When we come, once you complete that, what we will do is get into a little bit of information in regards to the Keystone XL project, which I know he's very involved in that. Also, what is taking place with much of the spills that took place in the Gulf as a result of the BP spill. But, Alan, could you take just a minute or so just to reintroduce yourself to our guests, I mean to our listeners? Thank you.
Sure. I'm involved right now in trying to organize casino workers in the Indian gaming industry who are forced to work in these smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages and without any rights under state or federal labor laws. We're working in at the casinos in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan right now. And you know, I've been very involved in the peace movement, the environmental movements, organizations seeking to educate people about socialism as an alternative to capitalism. I just think it's important that people get involved in their own communities, and we form a vast network of grassroots and rank-and-file activists to confront these problems that exist in this country, that the foundation-funded organizations that we've relied on for so long, they aren't doing anything. So we've got to step forward. And, you know, like a friend of mine said, he didn't see any leaders working on some of these problems. So he decided he had to become a leader himself. And I think we all got to take this responsibility upon ourselves right now in this country if we want to see real changes.
Exactly. Alan, I like what you mentioned about affirmative action, because I believe right now, affirmative action, we desperately need that in this country. I look at when I go into Los Angeles and certain parts of San Diego County here in California, we have as much as 40 to 45% unemployment in many of the minority communities, especially in the black communities, high unemployment in the Hispanic community. But just share with us a little bit about the importance of why we need to have affirmative action today.
Well, I think the reason is very simple, and that's that there's no other way to solve the problems of the long history of racism and employment in this country, not only in employment, but in housing and education. And Lyndon Johnson, the United States Congress signed the civil rights legislation back in the 60s, and they left out any way to really solve the employment problem, racism and the employment problem. Lyndon Johnson had to use his executive order privilege to create affirmative action, which is Federal Executive Order 11246. And he had to do this because he knew that his own Democratic Party would not support affirmative action, because there is so much money to be made in racism by these big corporations. If they keep people divided based on race, who stands to gain? It's the corporations who can pay lower wages to everybody. If people get together, black and white and Hispanic people and Asian people and Native American people, if we all get together and confront the bosses, we've got a lot more leverage. Well, they've used, you know, the racism in this country to drive down wages for many, many years. And our whole history of this country, if you go back, to the time when the land was and the resources were stolen from Native Americans, it was all done under racist pretenses, just like slavery. And so we need affirmative action to overcome this historical racism that still permeates American society. And face it, unless affirmative action is enforced, the situation, the poverty in communities of color is going to keep getting worse. Women are going to continue to suffer. Also, affirmative action is meant to help the handicapped, who are many of whom are living in, you know, just terrible poverty conditions. So, affirmative action is very important. Mm-hmm. I'm here in Michigan right now, and I should point out that the United States Court of Appeals, many people may not know that the voters of the state of Michigan voted to ban affirmative action enforcement in the state of Michigan. So for
voted to ban affirmative action?
Yeah, by I think it was like a 52-48% majority. Yeah, it was a very racist vote. There were, in fact, that's what's enabled the Republicans to maintain power here in the state of Michigan, this racism that was drummed up against affirmative action. And the voters voted that affirmative action could no longer be enforced. And just last week, on Friday, I believe it was, and I've been very involved in this case and pushing for this appeal to be made, it was taken into the courts, the U.S. Courts of Appeal. And the U.S. Courts of Appeal just overturned this ban on affirmative action and said that it was blatantly unconstitutional and violated people's civil rights. This is a major victory that we're not hearing much about across this country. All we're hearing about when it comes to affirmative action is how affirmative action is dead because the courts have supposedly banished it, which is not true. United States Executive Order, Federal Executive Order 11246 still stands. It's never been challenged or defeated in any way, and it's the law of the land, and these politicians are not enforcing it. It should be enforced, and people should be demanding that it be enforced. You know, the NAACP and the civil rights organizations should be demanding that it be enforced. As far as I know, these so-called progressives and liberals that met with Obama, I think it was last week, they never even brought up affirmative action. I've talked to several of the people that were actually in these meetings. Affirmative action was never even mentioned. This is a disgrace. Ben Jealous and Jim Wallace, if no one else, should have brought up the issue of affirmative action and asked Barack Obama why he ordered his administration not to enforce affirmative action. I took part in a meeting with about 50 people in Bemidji, Minnesota, where the head of the Civil Rights Division out of Chicago came and tried to see what he could do about the problems that existed on Indian reservations.
Mm-hmm.
And when I brought up affirmative action, and several other people brought up affirmative action at this meeting, he said that he was instructed by his friend not to enforce affirmative action. And I asked him, who is your friend? And he said, my boss. And I said, well, who is your boss? And he says, Barack Obama. So Barack Obama has instructed the United States Department of Justice not to enforce affirmative action. We had almost $1 trillion spent of taxpayer money and on these, all these projects that American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and everything with federal funding, and not in any of these projects was affirmative action enforced. We can't find one single enforcement of affirmative action. A huge Bemidji Regional Event Center, a $60 million project, went up in northern Minnesota, and affirmative action was not enforced. Instead of enforcing affirmative action, as a number of leaders in the Native American community demanded, the FBI began harassing these people who brought forth the idea that affirmative action should be enforced, just like right
and
now.
And the same thing is right here in California, when you see a lot of these government-funded programs that are creating jobs for, especially on highway programs, you can see that there's no affirmative action that is being enforced there. And what it is doing, it is robbing many of the minorities, women, is robbing them from having good-paying jobs.
Exactly. And it's their right to have these jobs because it's their taxes that are, just like everybody else, that's going to into creating these huge projects. You know, even Richard Nixon was more progressive when it came to affirmative action than Barack Obama. Because,
no, he was.
Yeah, because Richard Nixon openly stated that when the people's money is being spent on these public works projects, everybody should have the opportunity to have the jobs, and only through affirmative action was this possible. This is right from the mouth of Richard Nixon. Anybody can look this up. And
right.
Lyndon Johnson said the same thing. This was the case they made for the enforcement of affirmative action. The first president in U.S. history since Lyndon Johnson signed the executive order 11246 back in, I think it was either 64 or 65, the first president not to enforce it has been Barack Obama. Even both George Bush has enforced affirmative action. You know, they didn't want to. They made a big to-do that they didn't want to enforce affirmative action, but they said it was the law of the land, and they enforced it. And affirmative action remains the law of the land, and Barack Obama is not enforcing it. He's doing Wall Street's dirty work.
And women should see that he has actually gone on the attack against women and the creation of jobs, good-paying jobs for women. But
right.
And yet they still went to the polls and voted for him.
Well,
a lot of it's because of lack of understanding and knowledge of what his campaign was all about, and also lack of knowledge that what is taking place in the work environment.
I'm not sure of the percentages or anything. I haven't done a scientific study.
I don't know the exact percentages,
but I know it's
very common. You can see just in the workplace, almost anywhere you go here in California, that it's very disproportionate when you see the number of men working in jobs as opposed to women, and also when you see minorities in the workplace as opposed to whites. And this is throughout California. As I mentioned, in Los Angeles and San Diego, most of the minorities you see, they're standing on the street. They're looking for jobs. They're just milling in the streets or just driving, as opposed to many of the whites. You know, they have jobs, not necessarily good-paying jobs, because all of us are in the same situation. And I know in the industry that I work in, it's sort of well known that you don't hire women to work in the shop. You don't hire women to work in sales. Women, you hire them to work in the business office, and you hire them as receptionists. Other than either of those two positions, women don't have a place, you know, in the automobile industry here in California. And that's, you can go from here to from San Diego County all the way up to the border of Orange County. That's the way it is. And you find that very prevalent mostly throughout the country.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you're talking about these construction jobs, these aren't poverty wage jobs. These are very good-paying wage jobs where people are making anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000 to $80,000 a year, sometimes even more. Yeah, exactly. And then they get with all the people unemployed, they're giving these people all kinds of overtime. It's essentially what the government is saying is that only white men have the right to have these jobs. But when the government doesn't enforce affirmative action, because that is the pattern that exists historically in this country. And, you know, as the economy has gotten worse, it's been the people of color and women and the handicapped that have been first to be laid off from these jobs. In the state of Minnesota with the Viking Stadium, we will see probably close to half of the people working on this project being brought in from other states, all white workers, when you have tremendous numbers of minority and women unemployed right in the state of Minnesota who should be getting those jobs. And see, people don't understand what affirmative action is really about. When politicians first start talking about these public works projects, they have a responsibility under Executive Order 11246 to put in place an affirmative action committee so that a study is done right away to determine who is living in the worst conditions, the worst poverty, and to determine if affirmative action is required to create a level playing field. I mean, that's the language of the law. And this is not being enforced today in this country. No place. I travel a lot, mostly three states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. I've been taking pictures of all these people working on these big highway projects and everything else, and it's almost all white men working on these projects. Every once in a while, you'll see a Native American or a black person holding up a stop sign telling cars to stop while some work is being done. you know, working as flag people. But that's almost the total extent of minority and women being hired on these construction projects. And it's not just a dirty shame, it's a crime, because affirmative action is the law of the land. And it's just, you know, nobody would argue if they're going 60 miles an hour and a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, they're not going to argue that the law shouldn't be enforced. They're going to pay their ticket. Well, with affirmative action, that's the law of the land. And these corporations, you know, there's going to have to be some lawsuits or something filed against them and the governments that are enabling these projects to take place without affirmative action being enforced.
And I saw right here in Orange County, they had a stretch of highway under the stimulus program that Barack Obama had at the beginning of his at his first term. It was a $60 million project just for a six-mile stretch of highway, and I saw no minorities and no women during that stretch of highway on the 91 Expressway involved in that project. Every time I went up and down that stretch of highway, I only saw white males that were on there, no blacks, a few Hispanics, and the thing is, you can see what's going on because you're only traveling at 5 or 10 miles per hour, and
right.
For a six-mile stretch, and it was no women on the projects. And here, as you mentioned, these people are making $40, $50, and $60 per hour. So affirmative action is something that we need in this country, need to have enforced.
Let me just
we're running out of time, Alan. And what I'd like you to do is just give some contact. Will you come back and join us again in the near future, Alan?
Sure, anytime.
You've been an excellent guest, and I like that anytime. Alan, could you just mention how our listeners can reach you?
Sure, they can call me. I'll give you my telephone number. That makes it easiest. Area code 218-386-2432. That's area code 218-386-2432. Or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and find my blog. It's called the Podunk Blog. But if I could, I'd like to read this statement from Richard Nixon on affirmative action.
Sure.
Because I think it makes an important point. It's short. Richard Nixon said, very bluntly, and I quote, "Neither the president nor the Congress nor the conscience of the nation can permit money which comes from all of the people to be used in a way which discriminates against some of the people." And then he went on and he said, I have it here. Oh, I thought I had it here. Well, I don't. But he continued on in the same vein. And, you know, I think that it's pathetic that we can't even get the same thing, the same kind of statements and out of the Democrats today. You know, we can't expect much from the Republicans. You know, we should, because they're public officials and they should obey the law, which is affirmative action, Executive Order 11246. But it's probably too much to expect from the Republicans. But we should be able to expect that at a bare minimum. We should expect Barack Obama to be willing to enforce affirmative action, and that he should order his Justice Department to enforce affirmative action in league with what Richard Nixon said. I mean, you know, if a guy can't use his Department of Justice to enforce affirmative action, you know, what can he
right.
do for the American people?
Well, and again, thanks again for joining the program. We have a lot. It was quite a few things we didn't have a chance to cover today. So I look forward to having you back when I guess probably within the next few weeks, so we can cover those additional things. I'd like to talk about the Keystone XL project, talk about global warming. I'd like to talk about what is taking place, some additional things on Hurricane Sandy, but because of the limitation of time, we can't do that. Also, people can reach Stuart Alexander, reach myself, Stuart Alexander, just by going to my website, it's Stuart Alexander Cares. We're going to be putting a comment page on StuartAlexanderCares.com where you can send in your comments and stay in touch with what is taking place with the Socialist Insight. Again, Alan, thanks again for joining the program. Ruth Ann, thanks for making this possible for us to come to our listeners every week. We look forward to having everyone to join us again next week on the Socialist Insight, and thanks again for being our guest. Have a good
night. Thanks for having me, and thanks for all you do, too, to promote peace and social justice, Stuart.
Thank you very much, Alan. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Beginning of September, you'll find DaughtersDevices.com fully functional. I'm waiting for you to go on over and make your purchases of any of our oils or our flower essence formulas or misters or powders, potions, and brews, because we've even got teas. That's the ancestor of aromacology over at DaughtersDevices.com. Thank you now for coming by to see us. We appreciate it.
Ben Diesel on Monday evening on Leahona Times. The discussion tonight is around Gaza, the people of Palestine, their neighbors who've watched these. It's like if you have somebody in your neighborhood that is constantly having wild parties. In this case, it involves shooting and throwing rocket mortars across each other's fence. They don't make for good neighbors, and you're not really sure what the whole fuss is about. And when the police show up and ask, what's this all about? All you get is, the one group pointing the finger saying that they started it. And so in terms of unraveling what the problem is, you've got one group that says that they're defending themselves, and they call themselves the IDF. The only problem is that they are the ones that hold the air support. They've got the naval blockade. They've got, large gunboats. Did I understand they're now pounding the coastline of Gaza, which has essentially been turned into a prison camp that, no one gets out without special clearance. And so you have the Palestinians on one side, and they're being constantly stopped, searched, questioned, harassed. There's a bit, it's been way heavy-handed on the part of the IDF to say that they're defending themselves. And the other part is that this is happening right before the election in Israel that will determine the re-election of the party that's already in power. So, I thank Ruth Ann for letting us have this, time on Monday nights, 7 p.m. Central. If you want to call in and discuss Gaza and the Palestinian question, the phone number to call in is 718-664-6436. That's 718-664-6436. 6436. So the people who look at the history and they say, well, in the 1930s, the man who became the prime minister, the first prime minister of Israel, made statements about allowing accommodation for the Palestinians. Well, in the 30s, the whole region was called Palestine. You know, so in 1948, the British, who had been essentially occupying, allowed the United Nations to settle the issue, and the State of Israel was created in 1948. The only problem with that was that, according to the statement that Ben-Gurion made in 1938, that when they became strong enough, that they were going to essentially allow Palestine to become an independent state. So essentially a nation with two states is the way that they sold this. And so down to present time, 2012, you've got over $3 billion a year going into the hands of the Israeli government. I think it's about $3.5 billion a year. And there's a constant expansion into, the other side of the fence, so to speak, the Palestinian communities, that there's new settlements being established. And this has emboldened the so-called Jewish settlers, that they feel like they have a right to to this land that it was given to them by Jehovah, and the different names for God. The question can't be settled by the religious zealots. We're not going to determine who has the right to the land. It depends on what century you go to as to who was actually living there. So I'm open to suggestions from anyone that has any ideas about how this could be settled. If you can't settle it as a religious question, and you can't settle it by inheritance, unless everyone is given, an equal share. And in the present situation, state of affairs, that's not going to happen, because one group's getting $3 billion a year, and the other is getting whatever they can raise from their friends in the Islamic countries and elsewhere. There's virtually no trade for the Palestinians other than working for their neighbors. And that requires them to be good citizens, as it were, to be able to get passes to go into the unoccupied areas, because at this point there's virtually no industry in the occupied territory. And so, it reminds me of when I started to look at how the island of Hispaniola became so bitterly divided between the Spanish-speaking Dominicans and the French-speaking Haitians. And I had a nephew that served, a mission tour in the Dominican Republic. And at that time, this was prior to whenever the earthquake, I think, was 2010. But prior to that, if Haitians tried to cross the border, they could be shot. And they would just leave on the barbed wire, concertina wire fence, rolled up barbed wire. And their bodies would rot on the fence for trying to cross over into Dominican territory. So you had an island divided by barbed wire, and considerable amount of industry, industrial development, luxuries as water and power, and schools and education was all going to, Dominican Republic. And about every 5 or 7 years, there would be a coup in Haiti. And so, the ruling party, ruling class would disappear with millions of dollars that they had, earned or acquired. And then someone else would come to power. It was all like clockwork. So, going back to the situation with Palestine and Gaza, the people who are seeking to regain their homeland are put at the disadvantage of having the ruling class, so to speak, in Israel decide their future. And that's, the classical definition of slavery is that someone else can decide your future. You don't have, a say in your education, your work opportunities to better yourself. So the question that people ask, in the discussion forums is, well, why? As bad as it is, why do the Palestinians stay there? And it would seem that there is very few options for them to go. And they say, well, why won't the other Arab nations, take in the Palestinians? Egypt and Jordan, Lebanon, or Saudi Arabia, what appears to be, essentially a dead end. They've become, more and more militant. I remember, back when they were doing Intifada, Intifada was essentially the, I forget what that meant in Arabic, but it was, more throwing rocks at the soldiers. As part of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So as I understand, the West Bank is essentially the West Bank of Jordan, that extends south towards Egypt. And the first thing that happened with this latest round of shelling was that the bridge between Egypt and the West Bank was taken out, so that essentially cutting off any escape for the people that are in Gaza City. And so there's not really a lot of future for the people there. But perhaps you remember when we had West Berlin was behind the Iron Curtain, and people in West Berlin could actually travel, leave, come back. The people in East Berlin were the ones who essentially were being, prevented from leaving the city because they might, try to get to West Germany. And you had the same thing back then. You had a city that was divided by, in that case, a large wall that looked like it was impregnable. But for those who remember when that wall came down, there were people with sledgehammers, pounding away on both sides of the wall until they made a hole in it. And so there has to be a willingness on both sides of the fence, so to speak, to breach that wall. And I mentioned Hispaniola. The conditions between Haiti and Dominican Republic changed drastically after the earthquake because the people of Dominican Republic, as it were, tore down the fence to allow Haitians to, come, to their side of the island, as it were, to get help. And so it became the quickest way to get relief supplies into Haiti, other than flying, into the airport, which was demolished by the earthquake. And so, there are solutions, but perhaps, what we have to determine is, who is instigating this this conflict. Now, for those who recall here recently, as recently as, October of this year, there was a standoff between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Israel. And the President of the United States, it appeared, in the staring contest, was able to stare down his opponent, essentially saying, no, we're not going to, bomb Iran, at least not before the election. So that, that was essentially a stalemate that, right after the election, since they couldn't have their way, as it were, with Iran, have you noticed that that discussion has kind of evaporated? We're now seeing all eyes on Gaza. And when I typed in, and you'll see in the description, I put in the words German, Arabia, Germany, Arabia, the Zionist, and America, that the linkage between these entities, I started asking people in the forums, who is holding Ben-Yahu, we call him Ben-Yahu, his first name is Niet, as in, the Russian word for no. And so Nieti Ben-Yahu has, been a thorn in the side, as it were, instigating wars that you can go all the way back to 2005, for example, that they started talking about, their plans to strafe Iran. And it's essentially being instigated by Israel, who believes that Iran poses a threat to Israel. Because some guy, we call him Ahmed, but Ahmadinejad, for those who can pronounce it, has made statements that he was going to wipe Israel off the map.
Excuse me, I have to interrupt.
Yes.
He did not say that.
Well,
if
I know.
You check back. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I should have said, yeah.
No, that's right.
As soon as I hear that, I just go red. I'll tell that now.
I appreciate the feedback because it was at best a poor interpretation of his words, from the Farsi, as I recall, either deliberately or accidentally, bad interpretation. They sometimes get the wrong terminology. But if you change the name to Palestine, as it were, not because Israel is evil, but let's just suppose that we were able to trace what the Likud party, which is the Netanyahu party, trace their source of funding. Their, you know, which companies support them. You know, they're the ones who are getting the $3 billion a year. And correct me if I'm wrong, they're like the third highest, recipient of foreign aid, in the world. So we've got, country that would be as insignificant as, I'm going to get in trouble here. So I'll just say Waziristan, or Kampuchea, and don't try to look that up on the map, or Chechnya, but because they're, supposedly friends of the United States, they're able to bring in these $3 billion a year, for example, and then dispense it into, we'll call it research and development. And so if you were to mark those bills, a significant amount of that money comes back to Americans, corporate contractors, shall we say, that work with Israeli corporate contractors. And these guys are involved in all sorts of schemes all over the world. From lining the pockets of politicians to, lobby for their interests, to building pipelines across the entire world, and of course we got to have pipelines because it's easier to build pipelines than it is to change the motors to where you can use something besides oil or natural gas or coal. But anyway, that's for a different discussion. But getting back to this thing with Netanyahu, if anybody that can recall his role in 1991, he was front and center in Israel during the first Gulf War excursion. And see, at that point, he was content to let the Americans, go into Iraq and take care of Saddam. Of course, they didn't do it the way that they were supposed to do it. They, let Saddam live, and so 12 years later, it blew up again. Apparently, although that's a huge stretch of imagination because there weren't any Iraqis even implicated in what happened at the, on 9/11, in 2001 with the Trade Center. So when you look at, things don't get built or blown up, as it were, unless someone has paid for activity to take place. There's considerable amount of effort that's gone into engineering wars for many decades, that for the last 100 years, shall we say, there's been money moved around. I first noticed it in 1990 when I was following the foreign currency exchange, and I saw money being moved out of South America directly into the currency of Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I said, well, what's the connection between Saudi Arabia and Israel? Well, it may come back to the discussion I heard on Coast to Coast Radio Saturday night with a man by the name of John Loftus, who's been involved in Nazi hunting, investigations for many years. And what he brought out is that at the end of World War II, Hitler sent the Nazi, engineers and scientists in three different directions You know, the Americas, North and South, principally Argentina and Uruguay in South America, and then the United States and Canada in North America. And then there was a certain number of engineers that ended up in Russia. And, in fact, Loftus said that they got better engineers because their rockets did blow up the way that ours did, you know, at that time period. You know, we got von Braun, who he compares to being a kind of a mid-level bureaucrat that became part of what's known as Operation Paperclip. You know, so you can look it up if you want. But anyway, he used the term Muslim Brotherhood and indicated that they were being financed by Hitler, you know, during the war. That their statement was, Allah in heaven and Hitler on earth. And when it became apparent that Hitler was going to lose Egypt, he essentially airlifted the Muslim Brotherhood to Arabia, to Saudi Arabia, which, you know, they became, you know, teachers in the madrasa. They became teachers in the mosques. And so that may have given rise to the Wahhabi, you know, extreme Islamic tradition that has become popular in mosques worldwide. And I, you know, I know that's a simplification. Not all the mosques are involved in it. But, you know, in, it's happened in this country, you know, not with the not with the Arabs, but with other, as it were, you know, extremist groups. They moved into the role of educators in key colleges and universities where they could get their ideas into the hands of school teachers, as it were. And so there was, you know, certain attitudes that for example, when I was in high school, I had a teacher that his notion, you know, he tried to instill it in us, was that everything that happened during the 30s, you know, if there was a depression, the government fixed it. You know, if there was a war, then the government had to take care of that. And so that, you know, that notion becomes popular in certain political circles, you know, up to present day, that, oh, if there's a recession, you know, don't worry, the government's going to fix it if we give them enough time, you know, like another 4 years. So the question is, you know, if you scrape off the patina, you know, the thin film on, you know, certain, you know, parties, for example, Likud, you know, everything that they are doing looks like it comes out of the, you know, Nazi Third Reich, Fourth Reich playbook. Everything they're doing to Palestinians is, you know, is straight out of you know, the pogroms of Eastern Europe and the ghettos of Poland and Germany and so forth. They haven't varied at all from that, you know, divide and rule mentality. And so if this is you know, something that that other people are recognizing, they see this this pattern of setting up you know, governments. And I had the question when I was, you know, in my 20s, why would the UN Security Council, which included, you know, Soviet power interests, support you know, the formation of Israel, unless they had a stake in it. And so I've suspected that the people running the government of Israel were probably, Marxist in their, determination, but more or less concluded that everything that they're doing, with Gaza, shows them to be, fascist, in the spirit of the, the Western dictators. And it's really easy to establish a government if the people think that you're, going to protect them against, their feared enemy. So you have to have an enemy. An example of that, in 1992, I first began to see, almost with the breakup of the Soviet Union, I started to see, media propaganda that the Muslims were an even greater threat than the Russians. And so it was almost immediately, since we couldn't defeat the ideology that had led to there being something like 80 million Muslims in the Central Asian, former Soviet republics, that it became necessary once again for the kingmakers to arm, as it were, the Christians to drive out the Muslims. And that actually goes back 1,000 years ago to the first time that a Russian prince declared Christianity to be the state religion. And that's a fascinating study in itself, state religions, and the influence that the state has is done by cracking the whip. There's a lot of heavy-handed, iron hand, iron fist type tactics on the part of the state. So it's kind of like good cop, bad cop, but in this case, the church, the state, sanctioned the church would be the good guys. And so as the people, were beaten sometimes without, any relief. There's no one coming to the rescue. Well, then the church would step in. And so the church would serve the role of pacifying, the people that the state cannot break with their iron fist. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so it'd be the term, of molding, the minds of the people. I saw this when I was in Venezuela. I was born, Catholic. My grandparents were Catholics. We're Catholics. We're Venezuelans first, and then we're Catholics. So the idea of nationalism had gotten on pretty strong when I was there, and it's somewhat remarkable to me that Chavez has effectively broken that mold, and that clay mold representing the influence of the church. It's one thing for the church to influence grown-ups. It's another thing for it to imprint an identity on a child. And see, I actually, this might sound like a pretty radical idea, but I believe that even in the United States that our kids should earn their citizenship.
How would you go about
in other
that?
Words, in other words, they can, because are we, because we're born in a particular state, is that our identity, or are we Americans, or are we, Catholics or Mormons? you know, what is the identity that the child, you know, grows up and they need something to imprint. You know, they can't be essentially left, as one of my relatives was saying, the idea of saying that, you know, the child doesn't have be influenced by their parents. Well, somebody better influence that child, you know, for good, because otherwise they're essentially left to think that all philosophies are equal. You know, that all pathways are equal. It doesn't matter which pathway you take. You know, we'll all end up in, you know, the same place. And if we look at, for example, and I've had this discussion with other people, I said, if the people in, for example, Ireland were allowed to teach their children Gaelic, and it was encouraged alongside of English, that there would be no conflict between the English and the Irish. You know, if their children understood both languages, the same thing could apply. You know, with the conflict between essentially Arab speaking, and see, they also try to make it look like they're all Muslim. And most of the Arabs I met were, had a Christian identity. A lot of people I met from Syria and Egypt, and that's also, you know, like I said, it's coming back to imprinting. So if we can find a way for children to, feel pride in their heritage without feeling militant about it, you know, that they feel, and maybe this is the problem in Israel, they're going to run out of Jewish people. You know, they've already imported all the Jewish people that they can from Russia and elsewhere. And I don't see that they're having massive success converting people, to serve, you know, in worship in their, according to their their precepts, you know, according to their doctrine. So if they're running out of Jews, as it were, which is essentially what happened in southern Africa, the whites began to see that they were, you know, they were in a decided minority, and they feared that that majority was going to, speak out with one voice. And so a lot of it is a fear that, you know, that, well, our race will become extinct if we allow these other people to thrive. And that principle, you know, you actually find going back in the Old Testament, the Book of Exodus, you know, reportedly the Pharaoh was afraid that the Hebrews would overrun the Egyptians. And so it's not a new concept, but, you know, it doesn't make any sense, you know, in this day and age, you know, for people to isolate themselves and think that they're, you know, I mean, you say we're the chosen people. I mean, it just, how often do people have to assert themselves, you know, to demonstrate that they are the chosen people? It kind of begs the definition of chosen, and so that was one of the things that was discussed on Coast to Coast, is that the Jews may be running out of Jews. You know, they may not have, you know, that many more to import to keep up a majority population. So if they were to allow, you know, an end to apartheid, take down the fences, take down the barbed wire, you know, people don't burn their neighborhoods, you know, blow up their cities and towns nothing better to do with their lives. You know, if they see that as the, you know, to be a martyr, as it were, for their religion, you know, that requires you to have people that are ignorant of a better way of life. Now, did you ever hear, you know, back when they started bringing, you know, Irish Catholics to stay with Protestants, you know, here in the States, there were different efforts to break down that division between the Protestants and the Catholics. But there was a mindset that had been in place for centuries that, you know, I mean, we're Catholics and we have to defend ourselves because, you know, we've been invaded by, you know, by the British who were Protestants. And for the British part, you know, they capitalized, as it were, on those divisions. And so that's kind of what I look at, is who benefits, you know, from maintaining those divisions, and what can we do to, you know, as it were, to turn down the heat. You know, how do you diffuse a situation where you got two people, you know, facing each other with nuclear weapons? Well, you know, it's been done before. Wars have been diffused. They don't have to become inevitable. And I think that they say it comes down to that mindset that if you look at the world, you know, through your lens, and this is what the world looks like, you know, because that's the way you were raised, that's the way you were taught. But if you live long enough, you may find out that the world isn't quite that way, that there are other ways of living, you know, perhaps better ways of living. Now, did you happen to see that article, Ruth Ann, that I posted on my wall? It's about accommodating refugees from Syria that are pouring into the desert of Jordan.
Right.
They're coming into camps that the camps were set up, you know, to, you know, give them a, you know, to shelter them from, you know, from being out in the desert. But the group that was involved was, you know, LDS or Latter-day Saint Charities, has partnered with Red Crescent, has partnered with the Red Cross, with Catholic Charities, essentially every group out there. At one time or another, the Latter-day Saints have worked alongside of those groups, you know, in refugee camps. And one of the first things they did before they set up the tents was they brought in 40 truckloads of gravel and put them down there so that the people, you know, wouldn't have blowing sand and dust coming into their tents.
That was a great idea, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's a start, you know. And then,
yeah.
In other words, if they're going to be there a while, you bring them, you know, food and water and what have you. But if this was, you know, and of course it's not going to be a permanent situation, but I'm kind of hoping that Jordan is going to be, as it has in the past, a place for the, you know, tens of thousands of refugees from Palestine, you know, and the, you know, as long as it looks like a turkey shoot or, you know, shooting fish in a barrel, then, you know, and that's what Afghanistan looked like in 1985. Essentially, the Soviets had gunships, you know, the Afghans, you know, didn't. And so the Soviets were, you know, essentially looking at a total genocide, you know, exterminating the Afghan resistance. And then the Afghans started showing up with, you know, shoulder-fired missiles, and they were able to, you know, not only take down a few of the Soviet helicopters, but a few of the Soviet generals that were in those helicopters.
Yeah.
And in fact, I actually heard a testimonial of one of the generals, General Borisov, is known online is General War, W-A-R, and General Borisov was at the Air Force base where I worked in 1998. And I got to, you know, hear him talk about, you know, what it was like to have his helicopter shot down, and then he became an evangelist, you know, to essentially bring the Bible to Russian military bases. The Pentagon paid like $2.5 million American, you know, for these trophy Soviet generals that they could, take down with Afghan weapons. And, you know, the Afghans, as soon as they got a hold of any degree of firepower, they started taking weapons away from the Soviets. They started overrunning Soviet bases. The Soviets couldn't get out of there fast enough. And so this is one of the things that, you know, there's the best option is to get the women and children out of harm's way. But because, you know, the people refuse to leave, and we've seen this, you know, as well in Japan, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf Coast states, repeated storms, that have lashed. The event in Japan was an extinction level event. Haiti, Chile, you know, these earthquakes and tsunamis. You know, there's a concerted effort to move people, you know, from their villages into corporate, camps, you know, cities, tent cities, what have you, and to herd them, you know, here and there like cattle, and, you know, to relocate them away from their native villages. And so the fact the Palestinians don't want to leave doesn't give Israel the right to exterminate them. So there's going to be, you know, an end to these hostilities. And I think that this time Israel will lose their prize, you know, possession is Jerusalem. And I'm just going out on a limb here predicting that they will lose Jerusalem, will be occupied by, you know, designated UN forces from many countries. But when Obama went to Myanmar and Cambodia and I think Thailand, it was obvious that he wasn't going to go anywhere near the, you know, area that was, the current hotspot, as it were. He was going to stay away from there, and, you know, thumbs up to, you know, Netanyahu. You know, they just, which I, you know, use as a wordplay for son of Yahoo. But the, you know, the aspect that, you know, the government of Israel has engaged in war crimes. And they, you know, use the term defense force. But there's been other, you know, so-called peacekeeping forces that have also committed war crimes, including NATO, when they went into Libya in the name of peacekeeping. And there will be a day of reckoning. I'm fairly certain that, you know, people who have suffered from this type of, you know, corporate relocation schemes aren't going to forget what happened, and at some point we'll be able to identify the money trail, you know, who supplies the weapons, who's the arms merchants. I don't think we'll have very far to look, Ruth Ann. I think that we'll probably find themes like Blackstone, Apollo.
Well, they have a different name now, you know. They change their name frequently.
Well, I'm talking about Blackstone Group as a partner with Bain Capital.
I'm thinking of
You're thinking of Blackwater.
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Blackstone will.
Yeah.
We'll hear them.
And so I went on to find out where Bain Capital had, spent their money, companies, industries that they've invested in, and found out that in 2006 they became, partners in merger and acquisition, what we call piracy, corporate piracy, which is kind of a redundant phrase.
It is, isn't it?
Right? That when they became partners with Bain, then they started going after, the type of companies that they wanted to essentially dismantle. And so they did pretty well, under Romney. They did pretty well at the beginning, as it were. But they had a philosophy that they were only going to recruit, two or three companies a year, that they were going to, clean up their image, like Monsanto, for example, became one of their first clients. That, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you about the offshore Syria, offshore Turkey, offshore Palestine, offshore Libya. If you type in offshore drilling next to the location where there's, a conflict, you can find out which corporations benefit, regardless of the outcome. So because that region over there is being fracked for a natural gas field, and we don't know how big this field is, but we suspect that there's a caldera that essentially turns seawater into natural gas. It's like a constant pump of water, hits the molten rock and metals in the caldera, and it just flashes that seawater into vapors, and then that forms into hydrocarbons as it distills. So it's a distillery process or a refining process that's going on under the seafloor, and by drilling into it, they just add more fuel. And they don't usually drill directly into it, but that's what happened in the Gulf of Mexico and the Sea of Japan and Indonesia and a few other places that this has gone on. But now they've got their sites, and I say they, and you type in offshore Turkey, you can find out, which companies are out there fracking the seafloor in the eastern Mediterranean. But we suspect now that there's a caldera underneath that's causing this, distillation of natural gas, coming up through the seafloor. And, of course, that all has to be captured and, shipped in pipelines. But it is one of the reasons, when you look at, Syria started looking for partners for the pipeline in 2007. They started looking for, partners to develop that offshore lease. And if you told me 20 years ago that they were leasing seafloor, real estate for, millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, I probably would have, started looking at my watch. Speaking of which, okay. I had a timekeeper. We have a few minutes before the end of it.
We've got 5 minutes.
Okay. See if you had any other questions. comments, but you know, essentially, once they start fracking offshore, then they're going to start, and they already have started. If you look up Zion Oil, Z-I-O-N, oil.com, they are the company who discovered oil under the Megiddo Plain in northern Israel. And, you know, apparently the Israelis didn't know it was there. You know, no one knew it was there. This guy actually found what he believed to be the clues to the map in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis. And he didn't live to see it developed. But around 2009, as I mentioned, they discovered offshore gas field in 2007. In 2009, they discovered that there's oil deposits onshore. Well, you don't find natural gas without finding oil, and vice versa. And so as they developed this field, then the assault on Syria is actually to take out, you know, one of those partners in that offshore field. You take out Syria, you know, there's just Israel and Turkey left, because they've already taken out Libya, which may have had a stake in it at one time. But it's just interesting that, you know, they keep finding, you know, mineral deposits and great mineral wealth. And so my friend and I were speculating what they found in Burma, that they, you know, have to go, you know, play kissy-kissy, as it were, with the military, you know, regime in what used to be the Golden Triangle. You know, maybe they've discovered a mineral that tells them that there's uranium in down there, you know, hills. So, you know, we're going to kind of keep an eye on that region. Because just as soon as they start pouring, you know, $1 billion a year into that region of the world, it's going to be followed by, you know, by wars and conflicts, and you know, they'll, you know, spend you know, what they need to do to move the natives to, you know, to cities, so that they can, you know, take their land as it were, by hook or by crook. And but it all points to mining. It all points to, you know, using mining for chemistry. The research now into the element table involves the properties of the elements, including the frequency of the elements. And that is such an exciting field. It totally destroys the current paradigm, because we burn matter to create energy. And so that, you know, that's been based on the idea that we need internal combustion engines. You know, that China needs coal, you know, to keep up their industrial base. Oh, really? You know, there's a whole lot of other ways to build, you know, industry without having to build, you know, massive infrastructure. You know, massive bridges, massive, you know, dam, you know, placements. You know, we just need to spend a little bit more time, you know, looking for alternatives that don't involve this, you know, this type of industrialization, because it's always gonna, you know, end in conflict. So that's all I have for now. Yeah.
That was a lot. See you next week then. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Thanks, everyone.
Okay.